I want to introduce our second decade, which is 1974 to 1983, and our panel facilitator is Raleigh Kane.
Kia ora koutou, good morning and welcome to Christchurch, all of you that are from out of town. I am facilitating this panel because I'm the oldest. on my panel is Michael O'Brien, Sylvia Bagnall, Mary Gray and Lainey Cowan. And they will introduce their details when it comes to their turn.
You won't get a turn anyway, you're going.
Oh, enough of that and you won't get a turn. I've just got a few scene-setting things done. I started in social work in the mid-60s, in 1965, as a social work trainee, as did Mike, as did Sylvia, as did Caroline Oliver, who's sitting over there in the middle of things. And I, reflecting upon that, I think that was a very significant thing about social work, that it opened up to a different population of people, to young graduates or near graduates, as some of us were, and we were helped to finish our degrees. And then, of course, we weren't given jobs because we weren't old enough. So many of us then had to go and do something else for a couple of years until we were old enough to get a job, or certainly old enough to go to the much-hallowed Victoria University. And at the time that I started, and Michael a year later in Christchurch, the only trained social worker in Christchurch was John Fry. And John Morrison was another one who had trained in Australia. Well, I mean, they were like kind of little social work gods, really, in a way. But I think that what I want to say is that when I think about the era, I feel quite excited, really, because it was a time of change. And we came in on an anthem of the times they are changing, of Bob Dylan, of movements beginning to happen. And it was exciting. And if I, for one, believed I could actually change things. The whole world, really, but I definitely believed I could change child welfare. I'm not going to claim that it did. But one thing I do want to say is the association was very active in some of these change things. And one of the things that wasn't mentioned in the last decade but was very significant, I think, was the report Social Welfare at the Crossroads. And I don't know whether many of you won't even know what this is about, but it was a very important report. And it was actually the first national meeting of the association that I went to. Mm. And it was held at a weekend in Wellington, and it was a report written to reshape the social services in New Zealand, and it was later presented in Parliament. So that was a very important piece of work for the association. And the other thing I do remember about the meeting in Wellington was that David Longy was there. I don't think he was a member, but he was certainly quite significant in the meeting, as you might imagine. So that was something I wanted to mention. Because for Michael and I, we were at Victoria in the first years of the 70s, and when we came out on our luxurious bursaries from the state, we were determined that we were going to change it. And of course, they couldn't sack us because they had us bonded. So we did do things that were probably regarded as quite radical. In fact, people used to go to us rather a lot. And one of the things that a group of us did within child welfare and sanctioned as a subgroup of the association was start a group called SWAG, Social Work Action Group. And we did things within welfare like boycott, going checking up on people to see if they had shoes under their bed and were taking a benefit. We said, we're not doing it. It's not social work. And we didn't. And it stopped. And I think Howard's going to say a couple more things about SWAG later, but we did other things. We demonstrated against our own department, placards outside. I mean, hello, you didn't lose your job in those days when you did this. So those are the early, we were part of the association. It never occurred to me as a young social worker not to belong to the association. And I think those were the times. That's what you did. You joined the union and you joined the association and you got on with changing stuff. And I then moved on to work in the health field on what I consider now, as I look back, a wave of feminism, really, and my anthem as I moved into this era of 74 is really, I am woman. And that was a time when health social work came into its own, really. It grew exponentially in the early 70s. And I think that was a very significant thing around the association, because the health social workers were in a different kind of environment to statutory social workers, where they had to compete professionally with a whole bunch of other professions and looked to how they did that in terms of picking up the education and training opportunities that were developed for them, and also joining the association and being professional. And I mean, I would just like to give a shout out to a couple of people who are no longer with us, who I think were very important in that and were strong members of the association. One was a guy called Tom Austin, who some of you will remember, who was he was a public servant and a public figure. He ran the Tiramoana that was mentioned, then he moved to the health department, and he was a probation officer at one time. He was a mover and shaker in terms of shifting things in the public sector. Would you agree, Anne? Locally, Ruth Goodland and John Morrison were significant people for us. So the beginning of this era was, and I think we were beginning to see the start of rumblings around recognition of Māori, certainly the strong movement of women within the association taking their place within social work and within the institutions. So, and not insignificantly in that, another champion of the Association of Social Work, Maurice McGregor, who was, as a member of this association, on the Royal Commission for Abortion, for Sterilisation, Contraception, Sterilisation and Abortion, and did a fantastic job, and even got social work written into that piece of legislation. And then he came back and worked with us in the health services and the voluntary sector in Christchurch for a while. So I think it was a time of a lot of change. But I do have to say, quite halcyon days, really, because it wasn't that difficult to say, we need a social worker there, and money would come for it, certainly in the health services. Or we should start this kind of social work service there, and you'd apply off for it and it would come. Didn't last long, but it happened, didn't it, Mike? Mm.
Yeah. The general practice stuff out of that.
Yeah. Mm. I'm handing on to you now.
Oh, yeah. All right. Thank you. Ngā mihi ki a koutou. Ngā mihi, ngā mihi. I was sitting this morning and work with the social welfare at Crossroads reminded me, I think, of one of the pieces that for me has always sat alongside the education and training focus, was the work of what was then called the Public Questions Committee, which was a really significant body in the association at that point anyway. And I want to try and do a couple of things, really. One is to kind of traverse some of the significant public issues that we were engaged with at the time. And then secondly, to talk a little bit about more specific association matters over that 76-78 period. Erica Brody, whom some of you will know, was the president immediately before me, I think. I was sitting here recalling going to the conference in Auckland in January 76 as a member from Christchurch. I'd been president of the Christchurch branch. Going to the conference and coming back as national president, and there'd been no discussion about that prior to it. It happened in the middle of the conference. Getting back to Christchurch and then talking to John Dobson, whom some of you know, who was the head of the psychiatric unit where I was working at the time, and I said to John, well, I've got this thing, and John said, that's fine, you take what time you need. He had always been very involved in psychiatric. And so I literally did, because we operated with an executive that was predominantly Wellington-based. Anne Corcoran was part of that executive. Margaret Cooper was the secretary. And it used to involve a regular kind of trip on my motorbike to catch a plane at the airport and so on. And I want to pick up three or four things. The first thing I want to try, if I can make this work properly. Oh, look at that. So, interestingly enough, in the light of today's contexts, the very first thing that I ever was involved in was we finished the conference in January of 76, and I did a television interview on domestic purposes on DPB reviews. Bert Walker was the minister at the time. And it was very interesting because the DPB review committee did two or three things. Firstly, it introduced counselling for people whose marriages and relationships were breaking up as a precondition to getting the benefit. And I remember some vigorous debates with others as to the appropriateness of that. Secondly, it cut benefits for the first 6 months after people separated. But what was really interesting, looking through the association journals the other day, was the ways in which social work practitioners managed that impact by doing a series of things, topping up benefits, hardship payments, and a whole series of things. And it kind of reminded me, I guess, about the way in which for practitioners, the legislation may say one thing, but then there become some various kind of pieces in practice that become possible.
We also demonstrated on the streets.
Well, that was the other point I was going to make. And one of the very interesting things that we did here in Christchurch, as a group of social workers, we marched on Bert Walker's house. And we had a demonstration outside his house in St Albans. Now, it led, interestingly, giving back to the discussion about the role of the religious groups, led by a Salvation Army social worker. The other interesting political lesson for me in all of part of the debate around that was an argument that, again, in the light of the current context, is interesting, that it was too easy to get on benefits, that DPB was encouraging breakup of marriages, and that's what led to the counselling argument. Mm. But what was really interesting was that Margaret Cooper, who was our secretary, was appointed to the DPB review committee. And we had a series of interesting conversations about that. The significant, one of the really important political lessons for me in that was in being in Bert Walker's office discussing some of the recommendations and their implications, and him leaning over the desk and saying, "But your secretary was a member of that group." The implication being that therefore tied us into that. We had not nominated her, he had appointed her directly. She was working, somebody help me out, she was working in Wellington for an organisation that worked with single parents, sole parents. I can't even remember what the organisation was called. Was it Birthright? Okay. And so, you know, her professional expertise was in the area. So it was a really interesting lesson. The second bit, just to just flick through that. Sorry.
Oh, that's impressive.
The second bit just was the Royal Commission on Contraception, Sterilisation and Abortion, which, again, Rayleigh has mentioned. And I recall being involved with lots of others, both social workers and others, in a series of marches around the square in Christchurch around the right to abortion. As a sort of central piece. Mm. But again, picking up the same theme that was in the DPB was the emphasis on counselling that Rayleigh has alluded to as a part of that, and the establishment of panels particularly that became part of that. The third issue that just again is interesting that I wanted to just pick up was some work we did around unemployment. That 76, 78 was the beginnings of significant unemployment. And particularly the way what we were focusing on, which seemed to me as I think back now was really significant, was the way in which unemployment impacted on those who were the most vulnerable. And I was working in a psychiatric unit at the time, was particularly focused around how the unemployment was impacting on people with a range of mental health issues. So that became the unemployment issue. I meant to go back yesterday and have a look at what the unemployment numbers were and didn't get that done, but it was certainly much less, obviously, than we're talking about now. But it was the first point at which there was significant growth in unemployment following the oil shock in 74. We did a lot of work with the media, but it was a much, you know, someone was making the comparison before about letters and emails and so on. We would write a press statement, and then I'd hop on my motorbike, I was working at Princess Margaret Hospital, and do the rounds of the media. I'd go to the press, it was a circuit. It used to go to the press, the Star, Television New Zealand, Radio New Zealand. I think that was the circuit, because I could kind of do that without doubling back. And I had a friend I played cricket with, who produced the news at TV1. And John said to me, you have to be in here by 4 o'clock if you want to get it on the 6 o'clock news. So that was the driving thing, that I had to get it written and into John's hands before 4 o'clock in the afternoon if we wanted to get on the 6 o'clock news at night. And I learned a lot from that kind of process, but they were all written, delivered by hand, and it was an interesting kind of exercise. So, and particularly complicated to some extent because I was here and most of the executive were in Wellington and a lot of the work was being done by the Public Questions Committee, so trying to kind of manage those sort of processes. But that media work, I learned a lot about, you know, going to doing stuff on Morning Report, and I had 3 points I wanted to make. And I didn't give a damn what question they were asking. I learned how to kind of reroute the question to make the points that I wanted to make. And I've often sat and listened to interviews subsequently on Morning Report and realised those things haven't changed. Just two other things. One of the things that strikes me as I look back was the significance of key public service figures, senior public service figures, and of our relationship with senior public service. We used to have a regular meeting with the then Director General. So every couple of months, if I recall rightly, we'd meet with him and his senior staff in his office as a sort of a regular briefing thing in which we'd have some issues we wanted to talk about, and he would likewise. And similarly, we used to meet regularly with the then minister. I'm not sure that we got very far, to be quite blunt about it. But at least there was an avenue, there was a voice, there was a kind of route that which we could do. And I was going, as part of the sort of getting some thoughts together for today, was going through Social Work Journal, the Social Work, what was the journal called? New Zealand Social Work Review. Whatever it was, anyway. Yeah, that one, there. And it's very interesting. There's a report in there of a talk to the Christchurch branch in 1978 given by one of the three state services commissioners. Now, it's not that the content is not significant in itself, but what struck me as interesting looking at that, he was a senior public servant in the State Services Commission coming and spending some time talking about administering social services and administering public services to the local branch here in Christchurch. And it reflects a really interesting kind of set of connections, I think, in that. Just finally, I just want to pick up a couple of things around association matters at the time. Flick that on. There was a working party in Christchurch in 1978 which recommended that we establish a register of what we described as registered members. That got lost at a full association vote, the proposal for registered members. But that debate about who should be a member and what should be the basis of membership was a really central kind of debate. The second thing which you'll see there was the 1978 conference. And those of you who are old enough to remember that was... there were two things. We managed to get Ivan Illich to that conference. And I was lucky enough to have the job of driving him from Wellington to Palmerston North. It was probably two of the most interesting hours I've ever spent driving anybody anywhere. But then there's a photo in one of the journals somewhere of a gathering for those of you who know Massey University, in the foyer of the Social Sciences Tower, with people sitting on the floor and so on, and Ivan Illich talking about a whole range of really interesting stuff. So that was one very powerful memory. The other was a panel that we had at that conference. And it was the year of the election, and we'd gathered some stuff together around priorities, and we got a panel of representatives from various political parties to come for an hour to the gathering. And Ozzie Malcolm, who had been a social worker in child welfare, was the associate spokesperson, I think, from memory, for the government, associate spokesman on social welfare. And he started off, and he made some comment about unemployment. And somebody sitting in the front row said, and I think it was Bill Runciman, but I would maybe doing him a disservice. And Bill made some comment. Ozzie said, "Are you calling me a liar?" To which many in the audience replied, "Yes, we are." And he got up and walked out. we thought at the time that was deliberately constructed because it took the attention away from the debate, and the whole thing got then focused around how badly he had been treated by the the association.
His own profession.
Yep. And it was a really interesting debate then about how do we deal with that issue. But it was clear, in my view, it was clearly well and truly provoked. There was a set, what, the other, I'll just go back for a minute. Again, that issue that just I touched on before, what sort of an association should we be? Debates about registration, about a union. You'll see there's a report I just noticed on the table today about a social work union. Membership depended on being employed in what was called an approved agency, and the association ran a register of approved agencies that became the basis of membership. So some of those debates, I think, are very much sort of attuned for some of the current debates. Just one final comment to add to the comments, I think, earlier on about MERV's significance. I joined the association fairly soon after, I think from memory, after starting working in child welfare in Invercargill in 68. My first, I went to a conference in Dunedin, I can remember, about juvenile delinquency, if I remember rightly. And then MERV was in Invercargill in about the middle, I'm sure it was the middle of 69, and we had a meeting. For those of you who know Invercargill, I was back down there again last week, meeting at what's called the Band Rotunda that sits in the middle of Queen's Park in Invercargill. And there were about 20 or 30 of us, including Anne Corcoran was referred to. Sheena Reid was involved in that as well, and Sheena was a colleague of mine in child welfare at the time. But that was my first connection with MERV, was at that at a gathering there in Invercargill, and MERV was also very significant. I was overseas at doing a master's at York in 1980, and was they said to me, did I want to do a PhD? And I said, oh, yes, please, or something like that. And so I wrote to MERV and said, you know, what's the possibilities for funding? Because we had no, we'd use whatever funding we had to get to England in the first place. MERV said, I can't think of any source of funding, but there's a job here if you want one. So I said, that'll do, I'll go home.
Yeah.
So the rest is those AFS.
Well done. Thank you, Michael. Sylvia.
Well, I'm a bit of a hoax because I've been a social worker since 1965, but I wasn't actually doing a lot of it for some of this era. I had three preschoolers in 1974, which meant I had three adolescents in 1984. and in those days, it was hard to get a part-time job in a statutory agency. So you couldn't be a part-time social worker in the hospital. I applied and was told there's no such thing, and you certainly couldn't in child welfare, and maybe except for some very specialist jobs. However, it was also the year that my then husband gave up teaching at Te Reo Moana, and we went into an alternative sort of lifestyle, because those were the days. So it was the best of times and the worst of the times, and I've got the buttons to prove it.
Well, that's quite a good collection, actually. Look.
Couldn't find some of them. Apartheid, close the consulate. Up from under, this is a feminist one. Thursdays in Black, demanding a world without rape and violence. Actually, I think that was about 1984. It was a later one. And we wore black all day on Thursdays. Nowadays in Wellington, people wear black every day. So. Probably because we haven't not created a world without rape and violence. But we're working on it. ANZUS makes New Zealand a nuclear target. Because this was the Muldoon years. And 1974 is when Kirk died. 1984 is when the Longy government came in. And it came in allegedly because Marilyn Waring crossed the floor and wanted to support the Labour vote against nuclear weapons, nuclear ship visits. Actually, it was really because Muldoon had run out of money. So all the funding that you talked about came from debt. And Muldoon had a lot of good ideas, but they weren't good economic ideas. Think Big was supposed to create employment. He really wanted to create more employment. And we had all sorts of schemes. We had PEP, so a lot of the tracks and things we walk on. VOTP, a lot of social workers and other people started by working in a voluntary agency with some funding from government. And there were Keep New Zealand Beautiful. So when I drive along the motorways and there's lovely trees, that was a Muldoon scheme. So there were good things happening. And he created work for gangs, had a good relationship with gangs. So we hated Muldoon, but actually, you're looking back, some of his legacy was pretty okay.
Not
we still hated him.
yeah. So my career, I was a play centre supervisor, and I went I was doing things like market research, helping in a bookshop, and my husband was doing woodwork and he started making looms for weavers, so I thought, well, there's probably a few books you could sell by mail order to support this not very earning job he had. And it turned out there were heaps, so I created this wonderful mail order book service. But after a year or two, I thought, actually, I don't want to do this. I'm a social worker. So then I got a job in Parkview after the abortion law reform, and I was in, because they had part-time jobs, it suited them, as an abortion law, abortion pregnancy counsellor. And that was part-time, and my kids were at school then, and that worked quite well. It wasn't as people imagined that we were there to talk women into having abortions. In fact, we were there to help them make sure that made the right decision for them. So feminism was big. We had women's health collectives. We had, before the law went through, there was SOS that would send women to Australia if they were desperate for an abortion.
Save Our Sisters.
Save Our Sisters. Thank you.
Yes.
It also, 74 was when the first Ohu opened, and Ohu were like kibbutz-type things that the government actually provided the land for and supported people getting into. The last one disappeared about 20 years later, I think. Well, it was Kirkandrata. Yeah. Also, Mana Motuhake started in this era. I was a member, but I was also a member of Values.
Yeah.
I haven't. I didn't keep all my badges, or people pinch them, or they fall off. The other thing, interesting movement, I think, in this time is the so-called human potential movement that started in American California, human growth movement, and it was coming out of a really repressive, prescriptive kind of nuclear family, heteronormative kind of thing. It was state heteronormative. People started running growth groups, yes. And these were for well people, not for ill people. This kind of spun out a bit. Centrepoint, Bert Potter. But the thing is, you went along, and I went to some, and in fact, my 30th birthday was spent at a social work educator-led encounter group in my house.
Them at Victoria.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. People were sleeping everywhere, not necessarily with their partners. I had my first, and probably only few, goes at smoking weed with social workers. We were at the head of the movement.
The police were down the far end.
And I think we were looking at, I think some of the understanding was that some of our neuroses came from sexual repression and I mean, I think as a feminist, I think from role repression, from gender oppression. But at the time it was that if you'd explore your sexuality a bit, didn't really matter how. So what are now called boundaries were then called hang-ups. Don't you remember? Yeah. So they were interesting years. Another thing that happened around this time is family therapy came to New Zealand, Virginia Satir, Esalen sort of things, and the family centre the Anglicans set up in the Hutt Valley. And I was working from their garage when we started a family daycare for Barnardo's, so I was employed as a sort of social worker then. And we were placing children who needed care with good at-home mothers who would look after them. There was no funding for the pay. There was funding for our wages, but not for the care. So the women had to pay for it. And there was a lot of judgment about women who went to work and had their children minded. I have to say that we were in the garage of the family centre, and I was working with my colleague Egypt Callaghan, who was Ngāti Porou. And that was a wonderful experience for me, but it was before the family centre had discovered Māori's, and she was terrified to go inside and didn't feel welcome. So she didn't go to the toilet all morning. They turned around and become a really bicultural institution. This is one of my badges of Te Aotearoa. Egypt introduced me to Te Reo, and I went to Te Aotearoa, and I'm still going. I haven't got much further, but I love it. When I was working at the time, I was at the abortion law reform. This is my hug, heterosexuals unafraid of gays. And I was working with a number of lesbians. Actually, I was terrified of them. I was terrified I might want to join them. I have, but I'm a late developer. In this period was the Moyle affair, I think, when aspersions were cast at Colin Moyle for cruising for a gay contact, and that was a terrible thing. Also, Marilyn Waring, who was our youngest MP, had to stay in the closet, though she was a lesbian. And I think it's this period that Brian Edwards was outed by Truth for not being married to the woman he lived with. So it was a very officially... and we had wonderful headlines about Muldoon's affairs on a so-called newspaper poster called The Double Standard. But, you know, officially we were still supposed to live like the 50s in nuclear families, and there was this whole counterculture movement going on, and social worker was sort of cruising along in the middle. It is also 1974, it's 40 years since NZAC began, and I think social work and counselling had always been providing people for the other occupation. In fact, some of the people who were early social work educators that you've mentioned came from a psychodynamic point of view. Remember, Mrs. Min was a psychotherapist, and Beryl Mason. Psychotherapy, NZAP, started in 1947, and the Federation of Marriage Guidance Counsellors in 1949, and they were set up to deal with the stress of people coming back from war with post-traumatic stress, which we didn't call it then, and getting back into marriages of women who'd been living pretty autonomous lives and suddenly having to have a man in charge of them again. So we were a later organisation, really, and looking at that area that looked wider than just the intrapersonal stuff. But I think a lot of our good teachers to start with came from marriage guidance and came from psychotherapy, came from counselling. And a lot of social workers have moved into counselling. And I was interested when I looked up when NZAP started to see that Merv Hancock and Charles Watergrave had moved something about making the organisation more bicultural, and that was in the 90s. So Merv stayed a psychotherapist, even though he was a social worker. So outed you now, Merv. So we've all got, there's a broad interest in how people live their lives. But social workers, I think, are the best ones because we look at the wider context. They're in the political context.
Thank you, Sylvia. Lovely.
Don't you all wish you lived in this era?
Well, I think I've got a hard act to follow after those two. And I thought what I would like to do is concentrate a little bit of my journey through the early stages of social work in the Department of Social Welfare to give you a flavour of what was going on there, because it's sort of almost a counter to, well, then moving into work in the association in some ways. So I'd started my social work career coming back from my OE and thinking, what do I do now? And I'd heard about this this woman who was a social worker who had a car to drive around, and I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good to me. So I had an interview in the Timaru office and didn't know much, wasn't much the wiser, but they said, oh, well, there's a job going in Christchurch, why don't you apply? So I did. I still didn't know anything about what the job was, but I got the job. So then I thought, oh, well, it would probably be quite a good idea to get some training and find out about it. And I'd heard there was this course that you could go for, a 3-month induction program at Te Moana. There was just one snag I discovered. The application forms for this program were kept in the Assistant Director of Social Work office. He was the boss, the remote boss. So anyway, one day I summoned up the courage to sneak in there, and here he is at his desk with the, presumably with the forms. So I said, could I have a form to apply for this work? And he said, oh, you don't need any training. Oh, so I slunk out again. So that was the end of my training in social work, for the time being anyway. So I learnt on the job from my colleagues, from their common sense, their humanity, their prejudices, and their experience. And so I was 2 years in the front line, and then that was the state of play, really, and that was the Christchurch office in those days. You didn't really need any training because you'd been a teacher, so you knew all about working with people. So then I was fortunate to actually to go into the first intake of the diploma at Canterbury University, along with 14 other stalwarts. And so we're on the course that Ken, who's here today, Ken Daniels, Dougal MacDonald, and Rodney Routledge were running. And that was a wonderful experience, particularly from the learning from colleagues as much as from the tutors. Social work, at that stage in the Christchurch office, there were no trained social workers. And I still remember the first trained social worker who turned up, Calvin Menzies. And he was like water in the desert for us basic grade social workers. The fact that he was good looking, albeit married, didn't actually deter us at all from seeking him out whenever we thought we needed his help. So it's very interesting to reflect now. In those days, I pulled out some figures that said that, what did it say? In a 1981 study, 73% of social workers had no social work qualifications. But 11 years later, only 10% of the departmental social workers had qualifications, even so. And of course, those who got qualifications tend to then get promoted. So it was a very long time before trained social workers actually hit the front line in social work in the department anyway. And probably everywhere else. The health sector was more keen on qualifications because they had to, they were in a power struggle with the other professions, and particularly the doctors and the nurses who were trained, and the physiotherapists and so on. So there was a real impetus for them to get training, whereas the Department of Social Welfare was, a law unto itself, of course, as government departments tend to be. So there wasn't that same emphasis on training. Though, of course, they were supportive of developing training programs, so I don't want to blacken their names entirely. One of the interesting things for me was, after 2 years on the social work program at Canterbury, coming back into the office in in Cathedral Square, and to find that the staffing numbers had tripled in size from when I'd left in just those 2 years. So that was really quite amazing, and it was that was in the that would have been the late 79 when I went back into the office, just seeing that huge growth in the social work workforce at that time. In relation to then NZASW, I had joined, again, having been a teacher, like Rayleigh, I was keen to for that professional identity and also the links with other social workers who were working in different different offices, probation officer and all the health sector and the not-for-profit, the voluntary agencies at the time. But again, it was a rarity for social workers in the department to be a member of ANZASW, and I think it still is, actually, which has been a real gap and lack in the department and its work. Mike talked about going off to a conference and coming back as national president. He, in his turn, wrote to all the branches and asked, what at that stage the decision had been made to move the office of the executive around different locations to save on airfares and transport and make it easier to manage. So I was the president of Christchurch branch at the time, so we dutifully wrote back and said, no, we weren't interested. And then went off to conference, and I remember Mike sitting me down somewhere and twisting my arm till I said yes. So I duly again appeared back in Christchurch as the national president. And again, like Mike, I went to Robin Wilson, who was my boss in the Christchurch office, and said, could I have some time? So he basically said, well, you can have what time you need. Obviously, you just keep your own job going and do the extra time. But it was a wonderful allowance to be able to, write some letters and the inevitable press releases, because Mike had set up this, quite a profile in the media of public comment. And I think my favourite time for writing media releases was 2 a.m. in the morning. I'd wake up with bright ideas and set me on a path of insomnia ever since. Yeah. It's interesting that you never quite know when you're putting out media releases about issues of the day, the benefit cuts, and I went through some, I didn't go back over press releases, they've long vanished, but we had a sinking lid policy in government, cutting back on staff, and that was a social welfare, justice and Māori affairs, commenting on that, 1% cuts in hospital board budgets, removal of mortgage priorities for families with children, and so to me it all sounds as though there's a familiar ring about what's going on at the moment. We never quite know what media effects or writing letters to ministers had. We didn't seem to have the same continuity of meetings with the minister. I remember one meeting with the minister of the time, I think it was still Bert Walker, but that seemed to end after that. And we never met with any Directors General.
Okay. Yeah. George Gear was Minister, I think, after the war.
Yes, and I've just got a little story about George Gear, because he came in as the new Minister of Social Welfare, and one of the things was an attack on beneficiaries. And I remember writing to him and putting out a press release saying that the average length of stay, because it was an attack on women on the DPB, that the average length of stay of a beneficiary on the DPB at that time was between 1 and 2 years, and he never ever commented on them again. So hopefully that was
well done.
It had some impact.
We probably
speed it up.
We're running out of time.
Okay. Well, I was going. Mike covered a lot of what I was going to say about ANZ ASW membership in that debate, so I'll wind up now and leave it to pass it on to Lainey.
Thank you, Mary.
Kia ora tātou. There's so many similarities. It was such an exciting era. I'm at this end because I'm the youngest, but I was also the last into social work. I was nursing in accident and emergency at Wellington Hospital, so I was very used to band-aiding, and the shock of coming into social work in 1978 was, I think I'd only been in the door a minute, or I might have even just got the job but not started, was going off and hearing Ivan Illich talk about social work as the disabling profession and thinking, oh my gosh, I've given up a secure band-aid for what? You know, am I going to do good? Am I going to do harm? And it was probably a good way to start, really, looking back. And I started in Wellington DSW, and I'm sorry Anne's had to leave us, Anne Corcoran, because we were recruited at Tiramwana. They had a whole day process. And as Sylvia said, it was the time of encounter groups, role plays, you name it. So they were recruiting across probation, health, and social welfare. I think we had to state a preference, but, you know, you didn't know where you were going to get put. But John Lambie had, you know, had an eye on me, apparently. Anyway, which was good in a way, so I ended up at DSW. But what got me in, Anne told me afterwards, is that in the role plays, I was the only one that got my foot in the door. So I think native cunning actually, you know, showed up early, you know, and there were all these people that were far too polite to actually put their foot in the door in the role play, whereas my foot was in the door. And anyway, yeah. So that's what got your job in those days, is getting a foot in the door. I have to say, too, as others have referred to, this was an exciting time to have a whakapapa of Māori, because at Wellington Hospital we had, Irihāpeti Ramsden, there were three of us Māori nurses there, Irihāpeti Ramsden, me and Pauline Hill. Pauline went on and I think to become a senior public servant Māori. And she and I did some work in internal affairs together later in a sort of interesting way. But with Irihāpeti, we were already, unpicking concepts like cultural safety. And I never know quite why that didn't take off into social work into quite the way it did in nursing, but I've followed it with a great fondness as a concept and held it alongside a lot of our work. So I had a couple of really exciting years in DSW in Wellington. What can I tell you? And I was really lucky because I came in at a time when they split this three-month encounter group training, where people got far too fond of each other, into two blocks of time. And I must say that was really good. Basic training, but I was very lucky to get a bonded. I mean, the young persons here, the privilege of going full time to Victoria University after less than 2 years practice on full salary with a bond that we already knew was legally. You were bonded for 5 years, was it?
Yeah.
But they knew it wasn't
years,
actually
yeah.
legally
they couldn't
binding.
Do anything about
yeah,
it.
It wasn't enforceable.
We all split.
Yeah, but I went back anyway. But I just want to say, and of course the joy of that was I was also on full salary when I did my placements, and on account of being a pain in the ass on the course. I think, oh, I was going to say to Sylvia, the badge she hasn't got that was I used to wear, I think by the time feminism had caught up with me and I was on the Vic course, I don't know how come she hasn't got it. A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle. Now, how many of us had that badge? Yes, someone stole hers. But it was big, you know, and it got right up John McCreary's nose. And we had a women's group on the course, and we were forever correcting his sexist language. He thought that he, you know, and mankind applied to women. We were, you know, incredibly resistant to that at that time. He had just lost John Rungiho as his sort of co-person on the course, and we were the first course that didn't get a trip to Tuhoi, which I was really sorry about, but... But what we did get was a trip to Raukawa, where who was that lovely professor of accountancy who...
Winiata.
Yes, Prof Winiata. Being a professor of accountancy, he'd gone back to Raukawa and business planned for their tribe the Ruamano development plan. And that was... I think part for me of developing, some concepts around community development and what you could do from a very grounded point of view and from a whole other profession like accountancy, and so that working across professions, I guess we got a vision, achieved great things for Raukawa, and it was great to see. And I, as I was saying, pain in the butt. I was not allowed to go on placement where I wanted to go, which I'd sorted out for myself with the Red Cross to an island off Malaysia. I wanted to work with Vietnamese refugees, but my supervisor was from, I'd rigged it all up, from an Indian university, and Victoria didn't think that was acceptable. And I found that totally racist and, you know, unacceptable. But as I said, I was bordering on noisy and failing. So I got to do a placement in a settlement house in East London that operated from a socialist community development point of view. And so it's great for me now to have rejoined the Fabian Society and, you know, come back to my social work roots. And that was very... just very influenced my life, I guess, in many ways. And I was going to say, of course, that when I started social work, I just continued, as one did in nursing, you joined the union, you joined your professional association, no question about it. At that time in Wellington, most of us were both unionised. We were all unionised, and most of us were in the association. And our meetings in Wellington at that time were huge. Probation... and it was terribly sad a few years later when probation decided to consider themselves not a social work and to leave the association. And I think that certainly reduced our numbers in Wellington because they had wonderful venues for meetings and they were stand-up meetings. They were, you know, anyway, great places. So and my second placement was at Richmond Fellowship. And I guess they had just started in Wellington at that time. And the shock for me, I guess, was realising that all the young women resident at that time had been sexually abused. Don't ask me how I found out, but it was a total shock to me. And I think I knew, because my roots in nursing were in psychiatric nursing, that the connections between abuse, situations of powerlessness and ongoing mental health issues, that started for me then. And I better shut up soon, but just to say, I was very lucky not long after I went back to Wellington office to get headhunted to move to Auckland. I was headhunted, why? Because... Well, when I started in social welfare in Wellington. The only other Māori in the social work team was in administration. We were a rarity, and I was recruited to Central Auckland on the back of a whole lot of social movements in Auckland, Accord, and work by the churches, again, as the previous panel was saying, working together to say that this department was offering a racist service, basically, and that there were far too many Māori kids in institutions. So my job was to front up at court every day and turn those kids out of SIF, not in. And also when I had a free moment to go to the institutions and get them out too. And in that way, I met many wonderful people in the Māori community. Betty Walk, heaps of NGOs, poorly paid, poorly supported, doing fantastic work. And at that time, I think the previous panel mentioned Kara Pukitapu and the work he was doing in the Department of Māori Affairs. Well, at my time in Vic, Māori Affairs welfare officers came on that course and definitely turned my sense of direction too. And we started, some of his turning the Department of Māori Affairs on its head, and oh, how we wished we could do it to, you know, child welfare, social welfare, was that we professionals reported into community meetings. For me, that meant Ponsonby Road, Department of Māori Affairs, and on what we were doing, and what we were doing professionally with Māori. And so that was people like, as he went on to become Prof. Now I'm going to have a middle-aged... Ranginui Walker, kia ora, and Pat Hohepa, Titi Whai Harawira, when she... anyway, and when she came in from the West. And, boy, they, you know, that was the beginning of being held to account in a very strong environment. What I found in court, by the way, again, was that most of the women, young women coming to court, were being abused. They were mostly coming to court for in need of care and protection because they'd run away. And I just found that incredibly moving. And I guess you... so this led on to some co-working. Liz Beddoe's still here. She of course, was holding together the association in Auckland through this time. And a couple of stories around Liz, I think, was putting me in touch with Cindy Kirrell, and we began, I think, some really intense work for and with Māori women on abuse, or on, you know, strengthening te kākano, te whānau. Anyway, there were a whole lot of things that came out of feminism, came out of linking our work with other things happening in the community. The League became aware of some of the stuff we were doing and called us into meetings all over Greater Auckland to account for... I remember one meeting, one woman saying, but this doesn't happen in Māori communities. And then she looked around her peers, and one by one, they informed her it did. And it was a hell of a ride in that way. I better wind up. Yeah, what else can I say? Oh, I know, I've got to tell you that at the same time working inside the department, I was so busy working outside a lot of the time, but... And I think that the thing about bosses, that through our entire era, what bosses did was keep head office off our backs and let us work, you know, in whatever way we did. But we actually got official permission to look at institutional racism from within as a bunch of mostly social workers in Auckland. We produced a report. They didn't like it. I remember the Director General at the time, whoever it was.
John Grant.
He said, do you really have to have a cover that's black and white? Couldn't it be? He was even prepared to have pink if it wasn't, you know, anything but black and white. And he said, you know, institutional racism, couldn't you even put a question mark after it? You know, and, but we were uncompromising, and the report remained institutional racism. He was grateful we called it in Tamaki Makaurau because that ensured most people wouldn't know what we were talking about, you know, at that time. But
fantastic.
And and okay. I guess that the work going on inside and the support we got outside.
Yeah.
And by the way, the other story with Liz Beddoe, and I think it's in our era though, so Liz may not bring it up, is when the association hosted a meeting to support two DSW trainers who dared to report this on the sexism of a couple of male workers and calling it, you know, beyond the pale of helpfulness for any of their clients. And they were getting severely whacked in their employment environment, and the association held an absolutely crowded meeting to have the department front up and explain why they weren't supporting their trainers. Anyway. Kia ora.
Kia ora. I think, do you want to take over, Kieran?
Thank you, panel. We'll just we're running quite short on time, so we'll only take two questions, and I'll bring you the microphone. Just wait for me.
You over that time about children in residential care and the racism that was going on. And out of that, of course, we all should know that Poateatatu came out of that. Mm. And following that, of course, came the new Child, Youth and Families Act. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to stand for, to acknowledge you.
Thank you.